Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello, and welcome to Stage 9, Trek FM's show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And we're back after our week off, but you heard us yesterday on our special 50th anniversary show.
Yes.
And today we're going to continue the 50th anniversary celebration by talking about another cinematic universe, which was created by George Clayton Johnson, the guy who wrote the very first episode of Star Trek, The Man Trap. George Clayton Johnson has written a lot of things like Logan's Run and The Twilight Zone and all that stuff. But he also co-wrote the original Ocean's 11.
Yeah.
And, you know, which of course spawned the remake, which was directed by Steven Soderbergh, starring George Clooney, and its sequels, and now a spinoff, which is coming soon.
Yeah.
So before we get into that, let's talk about a little bit of news, right?
Yes.
Okay.
A lot of big news. Big news coming out.
Yeah. The Star Trek Mission New York convention was this week, and they had some people there who work on Star Trek Discovery, including Nicholas Meyer and Kirsten Beyer, two of the writers on the show. And there was a panel with the two of them where they discussed writing for Disco. And, you know, they said a lot of things like, you know, it's primarily, you know, Brian Fuller's show. They're trying to help him get his vision across and, you know, all this other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things which was mentioned, which was rather interesting, was surprise, surprise, there are going to be tie-in novels and comic books.
Shocking.
I know. That's
absolutely shocking. After the floor regained its breath after the collective gasp, they went on to give more details, didn't they?
Yes, which are rather interesting.
Yeah.
Apparently, Beyer is going to be the sort of liaison to the expanded universe people, and she is coordinating along with writers for both the comics and the novels in order to create simultaneously these other stories which will fit into the stories which they're telling on the show. That's cool.
Yeah. It is. The connected universe takes over Star Trek now.
Yeah.
It seems that the connected universe, to borrow a Star Trek idea, is like the Borg. It has infested everything now, and everybody's got a connected universe. So it's fitting that Star Trek has one.
I'm wondering if this is going to officially be like Star Wars, where it's canon, you know?
Yeah, you know, I go back and forth on the whole canon thing, because it's just, I mean, it's like, can't we just have some fun? Why does everything have to be, oh, well, this is official. You know what? If I don't like it, I want the ability to disregard it. But, you know, it's the world we live in. So to borrow a phrase from you, what are you going to do, right?
I guess that's true. That's true. Yes.
Yeah.
But I have high hopes for this canon, because the people who they have working on the expanded universe are pretty cool. The novel is being written by friend of Stage 9, David Mack.
That's good news. That's really good news. And I'm all of my canon comments aside, he's a good writer.
Yeah.
I'm excited about that.
Yeah, yeah, me too. You know, he's obviously written a ton of Star Trek books in addition to, you know, the more obscure stories that we've talked to him about. But if you want to listen to David Mack talk about his writing process, check out episodes 2 and 3 of Stage 9.
Now, here's a question, because I was unclear on this. I know that Star Trek has had tie-in novels and everything. They talk about them on Literary Treks and everything like that. Are we now looking at a possible rebellion from Star Trek fans the way that Star Wars fans did? Because since Disco is going to have a concerted effort toward an actual connected universe, are they now officially throwing out everything that came before and saying, out with the bathwater, and this is official. If we write something in these books that contradicts something you liked in a past book, too bad.
Well, I think, and I'm not an expert on this, you know, Matt is probably the guy to ask, but I think that as it stands now, there's been a lot of, you know, like whether or not there was an official like break, you know, in terms of what's, you know, canon and what's not with the novels. I think that happened. And, you know, the stuff which is considered to be like season 8 of the various shows is considered to be somewhat canon, and the stuff that was written basically while the shows were on the air has already sort of been thrown out.
Well, then, but let's take something like the autobiography of James T. Kirk, which is a fairly recent book.
Yeah,
they have the leeway with this to completely blow it up if they want to. Like, if they want to work Kirk in somehow to the backstory with Disco, so long as they don't contradict the show, the TOS show, but at the same time, the continuity of those 79 episodes themselves are, you know, it's a little off.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if that happens. You know, I know, like, I think David was saying on Twitter that they still plan on writing all the other books from all the other series just like they have been. And even Beyer herself is planning on writing more Voyager books, which continue the series, which she has, you know, established. And, you know, I don't think that, I don't know, I don't think that they care too much. You know, they're not really going to put a label on it. I mean, I've seen, you know, a lot of comments online from, you know, John Van Sitters, who, you know, is in charge of the marketing and everything and the licensing. And anytime someone brings up canon to him, he's kind of like, oh my God, did you like it? Did you like the story? Yes.
Good.
Okay. Then okay. Who cares? You know?
Okay. See, that's the thinking I like. That's what I plug into. Yeah. That's exactly that. I'm down with that. Right on.
Yeah. But there could be a bit more. I mean, it would be interesting to see whether or not they reference anything in the books in an episode of the show here or there. Who knows? You know?
Yeah.
But, yeah. And the comics, you know, which is the other format which these stories are going to take, are going to be written by Mike Johnson and drawn by Tony Chastain, who are the guys who do the current, well, what was Star Trek Ongoing and is now called Boldly Go, the series based on the Kelvin timeline.
Interesting.
And, you know, Sarah Gatos is editing them, as she does every Star Trek comic, of course. So that's certainly a good team in place. They've had a lot of success in terms of tying stuff in, you know, to an existing continuity. And now, like, that team, I guess, will be in charge of both. I wonder if, you know, I mean, I don't know his process or whatever, but I imagine it's kind of hard to draw two books a month, right?
I have no idea how, like, what the production schedule looks like for that. I mean, I read comics. Yeah. I don't make them.
I think they talk about, like, if you can do a page a day, that's, like, you know, really good. So 22 pages, I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if Chastain leaves, you know, Boldly Go in order to do Discovery, but who knows? Yeah. But, yeah, you know, Mike Johnson and Sarah Gatos are two people who Drew and I talked to on Standard Orbit back in the day about, and it was really a lot about, you know, sort of like this idea of doing a comic while, you know, the series is going on and tying it in and making it semi-canon and everything like that. So go back and take a listen to that interview in Standard Orbit. And and congratulations to David Mack and Mike Johnson and Tony Chastain and Sarah Gatos, and can't wait to see what they have up their sleeve.
We're glad you're still part of the family.
Yeah. All right. Well, should we move on to our feature for today?
Oh, let's, Mike. All let's right. move on to our feature for today.
So George Clayton Johnson, a crazy guy, awesome writer, writer of many things, including the original Ocean's 11.
And actually one of my favorite old Twilight Zone, the one about pool with Jonathan Winters and Jack Klugman. A Game of Pool, I think it's called. It's really good. Klugman plays a guy who is obsessed with proving he's the best pool player ever. Better than the legendary Fats, who gets summoned from the great beyond to come and play him in a game. And throughout the game, Jonathan Winters, who's playing Fats, is like, you know, you sure you want this? Are you sure you want to be known as the greatest of all time? And it being the Twilight Zone, there's, of course, a catch.
Sounds good. I don't think I have seen that one, at least not recently. So
it's a great episode. It really is.
I'll have to check it out. Yeah. So now, the original Ocean's 11, it was directed by Lewis Milestone, who probably best known for directing All Quiet on the Western Front, which was like my grandfather's. Well, it was his favorite movie until he saw Saving Private Ryan, and then, you know, that took the prize for him.
There
but,
you go.
Yeah, you know, I think that's probably what he's most famous for, and this was one of his later movies, and it stars Frank Sinatra as Daniel Ocean. And
it stars the Rat Pack,
It
Mike.
Stars the Rat
Just
Pack.
Just say it stars
there
the Rat
go.
Pack.
There you go. Yeah. Yes, it stars the Rat Pack.
And a couple of other bit players here and there.
Just to fill
but
out
it's,
the 11.
It's,
yeah.
It's basically an excuse for Frank Sinatra and his friends to get paid for hanging around Vegas while they were doing a show anyway.
Yeah. So this was the first time that I had actually seen it all the way through. Had you seen it before?
No, I had not. I had not seen it before.
And what do you think about Ocean's 11?
It's there. I mean, like, if you... The problem is not the writing. The problem's all in the fact that it's very obviously just, you know, it's just these buddies who are entertainers just having a good time. And, you know, which is not a knock. I mean, you know, but it's there's nothing about this that you would watch it and be like, oh, this is one of the classics. Like, this is an event movie from back then. They still do this today where it's like, oh, Oscar winner so-and-so and Oscar winner so-and-so. Like the whole hook for this movie is see the Rat Pack having fun.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, it's fine. You know, I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of people sort of like the idea of it, but don't particularly like the movie, which is why they remade it. You know, I guess sort of like looking at it, you know, the wrong way, you know, looking at it as someone who has seen the remake, you know, and sort of backtracking, I thought it was interesting how it ended. You know, it's actually very different from the remake.
I mean, the ending's clever. In a sense, I almost wonder if it. See, I don't. How spoilery are we going to get? Are we going to presume that people are going to go run out and see the original Ocean's 11, or can I discuss the ending freely?
Well, okay, if you haven't seen the original Ocean's 11 and you want it to be a surprise, stop listening, but otherwise we're going to spoil it right now.
I won't go into great detail, but I honestly think that the ending is very much informed by the times where you can't... It was very rare back then, I would say, based on my own anecdotal observations, to have people do illegal acts and get away with it clean.
Yeah.
Unless you're talking about Robin Hood or something like that. And I think that very much informs why it ends the way that it does.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I mean, I don't know if the Hayes office was still in effect in that sense at this point in time, 1960. But there certainly was that mentality. You know, I mean, Scarface, the original Scarface, you know.
Yeah.
It originally ended with, you know, the Scarface being like, "You'll never take me alive," and then running into a hail of bullets or whatever, and they made them change the ending because he needed to be punished by the law or whatever. So they go in and arrest him, and then there's this whole like fourth act where like they put him on trial and he's found guilty and then they hang him.
Wow.
It's so bizarre. So yeah, I mean, Ocean's 11, the original, it's okay, you know? It's I think the concept is really strong. They take a really interesting stance on the material, and I can see why someone like Soderbergh would be like, I could make a better movie out of this, you know?
Sure.
And I don't know, did he or didn't he, you know?
He did.
Okay.
I'll spoilers. He did.
All right. Yeah.
Rewatch. I had very fond memories of the original, of Soderbergh's Ocean 11.
Yeah.
Ocean's 11. And, going back and rewatching it, I fell in love with it again. Like, I could watch this movie a million times. I think it's clever. I think it's fun. I think it's obvious that the cast is interacting well. I think that everything about it fires right. There are a couple of indulgences near the end that sort of, you know, like I sort of wanted to be like, okay, get on with it. Like, it's a little too in love with itself at certain points, but like I think it's virtually perfect. I love Ocean's 11, the Soderbergh version. What did you think?
Yeah, I love it too. You know, I was really, really looking forward to it because, you know, he had just the year before made Aaron Brockovich and Traffic, you know, where he was nominated for Best Picture and Best Director for both of them, and he won Best Director for Traffic. I mean, and then to follow that up with like, oh yeah, I'm going to do Ocean's 11, you know? I mean, that's pretty awesome. And I think that it's an extremely good movie, and I kind of fell in love with it again, just like you did, watching it this time around, because it's the movie which I think lots of times, I don't know, like I sort of overlook it because of Ocean's 12, you know? And I've always, and here's the thing, I've always thought like Ocean's 11 is the better movie, but I'm always gravitated towards watching Ocean's 12 because it's so weird and crazy and cool and different. Looking at Ocean's 11, just looking at Ocean's 11 on its own, it is kind of, you know, extremely well done. I love the way it's shot. I love the way it's edited. It's so, you know, funny and clever. And it is kind of like this type of movie. If you're going to make a heist movie, this is sort of like the gold standard for how you do it.
It's a movie that is so well done that it's ending with the Bellagio water fountain turned the Bellagio water fountain into the reason you went to Vegas for a time. I remember everybody who saw that movie at the time was like, oh, I got to go see that. And it's such a letdown when you go to the Bellagio water fountain and you realize that they play different music and it's not as cool as the movie. You're like, oh, well, I mean, it's still neat, but you know.
Yeah. This is the first time I had seen it since I've been to Vegas. And like last time we were there, you know, for the convention, I'm like, hey, look, that's the water fountain for, you know, my wife's like, what are you talking about? There is one shot at the beginning. It's like the first or second shot you see of Vegas where if you look closely, well, not only can you see the Rio, you know, which is where the Star Trek convention is held, but you can also see the In-N-Out Burger, which is where you go to eat In-N-Out Burger when you're at the Vegas convention. So that was pretty
which
awesome.
I could not find for love or money the last time I was in Vegas.
No?
Because Google Maps got lost and like dumped me in like two different alleys. I spent like 30 minutes looking for the place. I was like, yeah, forget it. I'm just going to an all-you-can-eat buffet.
Well, now they're building one on the Strip, so it's all good.
There you go.
Yeah. So yeah, I loved Ocean's 11 when it came out, and I love it now. Although at the same time, you know, like I think, you know, maybe here's the thing. It's like, it feels like sort of like a bloated, big budget Hollywood remake of Out of Sight in a sense, you know, same director, same star playing, you know, an ex-con, like a small time crook who's trying to do this other thing. And it's like, didn't we just see this like 3 years prior? You know, I mean, this just feels like you're doing this with like more money now.
What's interesting is I've never seen Out of Sight. Oh, so almost maybe
that's not
maybe,
interesting. That's tragic.
Maybe they got away with it because there were more people like me than you who had not seen Out of Sight. And so, like, I don't go into Ocean's 11 saying, I saw this 3 years ago. I go into it saying, hey, this is great.
Yeah, and that's fair, I guess. But, God, you need to see Out of Sight. I mean, you've seen Jackie Brown, right?
Of course. Okay. I love Jackie Brown. It's like the overlooked Tarantino movie that just absolutely should be loved and adored by all of his fans.
Yeah, well, you know, they're both written, they're both based on Elmer Leonard books, you know.
Yeah.
They came out like 7 months apart, 8 months apart. And, you know, Elmer Leonard's books, another shared continuity, another shared universe, lots of crossover in terms of, you know, characters and stuff like that. And these two movies were, you know, being made independently, completely of each other. And the character of Ray Nicolette, who Michael Keaton plays in Jackie Brown, that character is in both books, right?
Yeah.
So, of course, Soderbergh knew that Tarantino was making this movie, you know? And he's like, Ray Nicolette, he's in both of these. You cast Michael Keaton? That sounds about right. I wonder if he would work in Out of Sight. And Tarantino's like, come on over to the editing room. You can look at his scenes. So Soderbergh watched the scenes and is like, yeah, that's good. So Michael Keaton plays the same character in both movies, even though the two movies are completely unrelated aside from that.
That's pretty fantastic.
It's amazing.
See, that's that. But see, I also love stories like that because I love the idea that these auteurs are being collegial about everything.
Yeah.
You know, like that they're not being sort of like old school movie makers that are like, no, this is my picture, see, and I'm not going to let you take my star. You know, they're like, yeah, sure, use them.
Yeah.
You know, I like that.
Yeah. Definitely check out Out of Sight. It's one of Soderbergh's absolute best movies. It's so good. And one of the best edited movies ever, too. So
I will add it to my homework list.
All right. So Ocean's 12, on the other hand, I feel like that's the movie where, you know, almost like, you know, Soderbergh being Soderbergh was kind of like, I feel guilty about having made this big blockbuster, and I know that I'm making a sequel to it now, and that's sort of a sellout move, so I need to rip it apart and put it back together into something weird and crazy and different.
Oh, he ripped it apart, Mike. He definitely ripped it apart. But much like a watch, once you take it apart, it's very difficult to put it back together. It really is. Doesn't run quite right.
No, he put it back together like Sisko did in that episode where he's like going all crazy and he builds the
Ocean's 12, I was thinking about this as I rewatched these three movies. Ocean's 12 is like what could have happened with Empire Strikes Back. Because Empire Strikes Back, you come out of it, you're like, wow, I still love Star Wars, and this is great and different, and this isn't what I expected, and all of that stuff. And I came out of Ocean's 12 both times saying, oh, man, come on. You know what? There are five things that I think are giant mistakes. I'm not going to harp on them all. And I just, the movie just does not click for me. I think that the problem is not the cinematography. The problem is not anything except the fact that he did probably what you're saying, which is I'm going to go really meta with this. And there's a plot device in it that just, it's the fun. Like if he hadn't done it, I could have given it just a little bit more love, but it just blows it up.
That's the point, because like I watched that movie and I'm like, this is cool. He's, you know, it's set in Europe and it's a very European, you know, type of filmmaking and everything. It has this different feel to it. And then they're teasing this thing. And then they do it and you're like, oh my God, yes.
Nope.
And, nope. You know, I mean, the thing that I always bring this up, but like, did you ever see Schizopolis?
No.
Okay, that movie's insane. Straight up crazy. He made it with his friends. It stars him, and it's crazy. It's this crazy experimental movie, basically a home movie, and it's, you know, I don't know, not tremendously great, but whatever. On the commentary for that movie is Steven Soderbergh interviewing himself, you know?
Oh, man.
And, you know, he says things like, you know, what do you think about this movie? And then he turns to himself, you know, and says like, well, you know, I think that we really kind of, you know, broke things wide open in terms of, you know, cinema and the language of cinema. I mean, this is clearly, you know, the best photographed movie ever made, aside from maybe, you know, Godfather 2. But, you know, that's like how it plays out. And at one point, he talks about how he's breaking the fourth wall, you know, and he asks himself about that. Mm-hmm. And he says, like, yes, well, in this movie, I broke the fourth wall, you know, as being really experimental. In my next movie, I'm going to, you know, I found a fifth wall, which is actually behind the viewer. And in my next movie, I'm going to break through that. Mm. And then he says to himself, what movie is that? Mm. And he's like, Ocean's 12. And, you know, this is before Ocean's 12 came out, and obviously he was making a joke because the entire commentary is a joke, you know, where he's pretending to be this, you know, really pretentious dude, and he's like the absolute opposite of that.
Sure.
But then I sat there watching Ocean's 12, and that scene happened, and I'm like, oh my God, he did it. He actually broke the fifth wall.
See, you know what? If he discovered a fifth wall, I'm going to say maybe it was a door. And so we can bring it all the way back to the Twilight Zone. There's some doors you don't open, Mike. There's some doors where you say, hey, that's, you know, like seriously, the whole thing that we're skirting around to be spoiler free about it and everything. It's basically an idea that comes up in like, you know, just a bowl session. Maybe he went to In-N-Out Burger and he's like, what could I do? And he's sitting there. And he's talking with his friends. He's like, oh, I could do this. Ah, ha, 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 ha. And what he was lacking was the friend / writer, whomever, to sit there with him and say, maybe not.
No,
this isn't a great idea.
You got to do that because it is a great idea, you know,
and
no one has the guts to do it aside from him.
Look, I'm not taking any points away from him for trying it. I get it. You want to be different. You want to do things. That's cool, man. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And that's just the way it is. I'm sure there are plenty of people in your camp who love Ocean's 12. I'm sure there are plenty of people in my camp who dislike Ocean's 12 and who like, I mean, seriously, if you take that one thing out of it, it goes for me from a 2-star movie to a 3, possibly 3.5-star movie out of 5.
That's crazy.
Like, it blows up the whole, all traces of goodwill that it had earned up to that point. Like, it hits it, and I'm like, I really don't like this. And then the Bruce Willis thing happens, and I'm like, I definitely do not like this. I definitely don't like this in any sense or respect of anything.
No, see, the Bruce Willis thing, to me, that takes it to an even, you know, bigger level, because now that you've got, and I mean, this isn't really a big spoiler, now that you've got Bruce Willis playing himself and someone else playing themselves, right?
It's someone else playing someone playing themselves.
But regardless of any of that, you've got Bruce Willis and this other specific person playing themselves. And those two specific people also shared a scene as themselves, essentially, in The Player by Robert Altman, which means that the Oceans movies take place in Player continuity.
Oh no. No, they don't.
And actually, don't, The Player and Ocean's 12 would make a great double feature.
No.
Yes.
No. See, at this point, the madness must stop. And we're going to go back and forth. We're just going to go in circles. And what I will say is that the other things that I knock it for largely have to do with the way that Catherine Zeta-Jones's character is used and tied into the movie. The way her plot is tied in with Rusty's plot,
I mean,
doesn't work for me.
Maybe, but that character, I love that character so much. You know, she's probably my favorite character in all
of
these movies.
I'm not knocking the character. I just think that the plotting gets a little clumsy with Ocean's 12.
Okay. All right. Maybe. But and I guess most people do agree with you because they totally pulled an Alien 3 on this and decided to just go back to the tried and true formula for Ocean's 13, where it's like literally like the same movie as Ocean's 11,
Well, to keep extending the metaphor with the Star Wars movies, it's Return of the Jedi.
There you go. That's what it is.
You got another Death Star. You got to take it out. All right, let's get the crew back together. Okay, this time the bad guy's really super evil.
Yeah.
And, you know, we got to take him out. Okay. Like, I like that. It works for me.
So you like Ocean's 13?
I do, very much. Because I think what makes it work is that you have Al Pacino back, over the top Al Pacino, for sure. But he still cared in this movie.
Yeah.
Because I think there's an argument that could be made that Pacino's just sort of skating by now. No disrespect to the man. He's earned it. But you also, I mean, Ellen Barkin is fantastic. Mm-hmm. She's absolutely wonderful in this movie. And you know what? And another thing that gives it a lot of a bump for me is the Khan and Affleck's subplot with the Dice Factory.
Yeah.
I think it's just so hysterically funny.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I would watch the movie 100 times just for that. It's so great.
I like it. I've always liked it, but at the same time, especially after Ocean's 12, I was like, oh my God, I can't wait to see this. And then, you know, I watched it and I'm like, well, that is really straightforward and pretty much the same thing as the first time around. And I was really let down by it. And I mean, I do think that it's good. And now, like, the more that I see it, I've seen it a few times since then. Every time I see it, I'm like, you know, I appreciate it, you know, because I appreciate, again, like, the skill at, you know, at which it was made. And, you know, I like that, like, this time through, I'm like, there's a lot of disguises. Like, they just do disguises like crazy in that movie this time around.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there's a lot of stuff that I think is really good, like Al Pacino and stuff like that. And, you know, the photography is really nice and everything, but it's just, to me, disappointing in that it is kind of just a rehash. It's so safe after doing something so out of the box with Ocean's 12 to just say, like, okay, people didn't like that. Let's just go back to that thing that we know people like. That was disappointing to me, you know?
See, it's so interesting, though, to have, you know, that sort of, this sort of discussion. I think it's so all of us, every single person, we could all be accused of selectively applying that sort of reasoning as to why we didn't like a sequel.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's very intriguing to me. But I think what's also intriguing is that you said, like, you really liked what came before, and then this sort of disappointed you, but you can still go back and you can watch and you can be like, you know what, it does work really well. Okay, it does, you know, this is really photographic. Okay, it does flow. And I think possibly it's not just the template. I think it's the motivation that makes Ocean's 13 work better.
Yeah.
Because it's not just this outright pride thing, blah, 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 blah. This is, we're getting revenge for our decent friend who was wronged by this person.
Yeah.
I think everybody can plug into that.
Sure. Sure. I mean, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. But I'd like to see something different. And
yeah,
maybe now we will get to see something different because there's a spinoff in the works. Steven Soderbergh is not directing it because he retired from directing, although he is making a movie now. And it's directed by Gary Ross, who is a good friend of Soderbergh's, who made The Hunger Games, Seabiscuit, Pleasantville.
Wait, which Hunger Games movie did he make?
The first one.
The first one's good. I liked it.
They're all good except for the... Well, they're all good. The last one is just disappointing.
I kind of tapped out after the second one because I don't like the way they did the ending. Like, it really, as a moviegoer, I hate that type of ending.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought
it was the Matrix Reloaded ending.
Yeah.
It was like, well, you're going to come back for the next one. I'm like, oh, I beg to differ.
Fair enough. Yeah, but, you know, I'm excited about this. It's called Ocean's Ocho. And it's a spinoff. You know, it's not a remake or anything like that or a reboot. It's a spinoff, and it's about George Clooney's sister, who's also apparently an ex-con, who decides to plan a heist, and she's played by Sandra Bullock. And they already have the cast. I guess they have all eight people. So here's the cast. Sandra Bullock, and then Kate Blanchett is apparently the Brad Pitt proxy, you know.
Interesting call.
Then there's Anne Hathaway, Awkwafina, who is a comedian slash rapper who's in Neighbors 2. She's funny.
All right.
Helena Bonham Carter, Mindy Kaling, Sarah Paulson.
There you go.
And Rihanna.
Rihanna.
Yeah.
So is Rihanna playing the character from her Star Trek Beyond video?
I don't think so.
Oh, that's unfortunate, because we could have tied that continuity together then.
Yeah, maybe she's playing herself, in which case it would fit into This Is the End continuity.
Oh, well, yes, I suppose it could.
I don't know. We'll see. And apparently there's a rumor that Elizabeth Banks is going to be in it, but that would be 9. But maybe Elizabeth Banks is the bad guy. Who knows?
Yeah, they didn't count Andy Garcia in the first one.
Yeah. And honestly, once they got to like Ocean's 12, I think they were kind of fudging the numbers a bit. Like, you're
just
like,
just a little.
Who's number 13 in Ocean's 13? Do you count him? But then how could you not count?
I think they treated it like a sports team roster. The 13th was just a rotating slot. You know, you could call in somebody from the bench to pinch hit in a situation.
Yeah, yeah. So yes, Ocean's Ocho, coming soon to a theater near you. And it's kind of cool that, you know, it's like George Clayton Johnson, he writes this movie along with a few other people, you know, back in 1960, just so that, you know, Frank Sinatra and his pals can hang out in their favorite city. And then it gets turned into this massive thing where not only is there like a trilogy of movies with like the biggest movie stars on the planet, but now there's a spinoff with, you know, the rest of the biggest movie stars on the planet. And it's like they're building a whole universe in a sense.
Yeah.
And it fits into the player continuity.
I will say that one of the neatest things watching all four of them, but even just watching 1960 to 2001, to see what Vegas looked like and the way it operated back in 1960 compared to 2001. And what's very interesting to me in both cases is, and I don't know whether this is going to get a hit called out on me or not, but they work very hard to make sly reference to in 1960 without calling directly out who really ran Vegas and who still really runs Vegas, to be honest with you. But, you know, like they dance around it very cleverly in that one boardroom scene where they're, you know, they're like, oh, we have a board of investors. And it's like, okay, guys, we know. It's like, that's as much as we're going to say.
Yeah. Yeah. That is interesting. That is interesting for sure. Well, it's been fun talking about the Ocean's 11 cinematic universe today, but that's not all we're talking about this week. So here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
I've seen some people panicking. Oh my God, the Andorians are now going to be purple, and the Tellarites won't be pigs, they'll be aardvarks. You know,
no, that
whatever.
Would be great if they were aardvarks.
That would be Talaxians, yeah.
Standard Orbit.
Although they did take the plot of Mars Attacks and use it to solve the climax of this movie by playing the music really loud and defeating the aliens.
Did you come up with that by yourself, man?
I did.
Wow, that's a great analogy. I never put the two together. Wow.
Yeah, that's the, look it up, folks. That's the plot of Mars Attacks.
To the journey!
Okay, that's going to just leave Chakotay with a bunch of guilt.
Maybe that's why he doesn't talk about it.
And then he's still married.
Oh,
right?
Melodic Treks.
Darlie's our new darling, our darling, our darling. Charlie is my darling. And I love that.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and discover what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. You can get them on Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, you know, and all the rest of it.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
Where podcasts are, you will find us.
Absolutely. All right, we want to thank our associate producers, Jeff Sutter and Chris Steftenagel.
Thank you.
Yes, yes, for sure. We couldn't do it without you. And if you want to be like Chris and Jeff, you can become a patron of the network on patreon.com. Just head on over there. That's patreon.com/trekfm, patreon.com/trekfm. You'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. So, we really appreciate your support and hope you'll join the team. Okay, so now we just had our iTunes contest.
Yes.
And we are going to now pick the winner of the Star Trek Beyond IMAX trilogy screening poster. I'm grabbing my my Indiana Jones fedora here. I'm shaking up the thingies. All right. I'm going to pick
drum roll.
Picking the winner. You ready?
And it is.
The winner.
And?
Hang on. I need to close my eyes. Okay. The winner is Davis Grayson.
Woo!
Thank Yay. You, Davis.
Congratulations.
Yes. Thank you. And thanks to everyone else who submitted a review. And we'll get that off to you. Toot sweet. That means right away, right? I'm pretty sure.
I think so.
Okay.
I certainly hope so.
Okay. All right. If you want to contact us, you can go to Twitter at TrekFM or go to Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM, or you can find the Babel Conference on Facebook. That's B-A-B-E-L. So just go over there and you can find us. John, where can people find you?
Kessel Junkie. Just look for that moniker wherever you hang out. You can also find me on Aggressive Negotiations, the Star Wars podcast with Trek FM's own Matthew Rushing over on the Nerd Party Network, and co-hosting Words with Nerds with my pal Craig. And where can they find you, Mike?
You can find me producing From There to Here right here on the network, where we look at two episodes of Star Trek a day, every day for the whole year. And you can also find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. So, all right, that's it for this week. Next week, we will be back to talk about Adam Nimoy's new documentary, For the Love of Spock.